Good morning and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia on a Sunday morning. We've we'll summarize the declaration in the sense that the purpose of the Lodge is to spread broadcast the principles, the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy as found in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. And what that simply means is we are a volunteer association of students. That's who we are. That's what we do. And we are kind of a family making the effort to keep these ideas before the public. The effort that we put forth simply is an effort locally and around the world to keep the ideas before the public, because these ideas are the ideas of the ancient universal wisdom tradition, which we're going to be talking about, a very interesting subject today along those lines. Everybody is invited to attend these meetings. It's not for any one exclusive group, and we don't charge any money to attend. And because it's an all-volunteer association, there's no room for officers or bylaws or any of that sort, but rather this simple declaration, which we would encourage you to read and come to understand, is the sole guiding document for what we do here in the Lodge. So we welcome to the Association of the United Lodge of Theosophists all who feel who are in accord with the purposes of the Lodge and who care to fit yourselves, ourselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. All of the meetings are free and open to the public. Those free meetings are on a Sunday morning from 11 to 12. The doors open at 10:30. You know, this month, for the month of April, the topic that we've been covering for the month has been psychism and spirituality. Nature's symbols of human evolution. Today's talk is on the winged dragon, bird, and the butterfly. Next week's talk is on the legends of human saviors. The legends of human saviors. So that's on Sundays from 11 to 12. Then, of course, on Wednesdays, the doors open at 5:15. There's a library available to the public, open from 5:15 to 7:15. It's a reference library where you can research as you see fit any of your theosophical lines of endeavor, or just come and read and prepare for the meeting later in the evening, which goes from 7:30 to 8:30. And we have references for the topics that the meeting is covering each Wednesday night. Wednesday nights, this year, we've been reading through the H.P. Blavatsky's book, The Key to Theosophy. The doors are open. Everything we all do here is on a voluntary basis, but any contributions of time, money, or service that you feel moved to offer is certainly appreciated, yet there's no obligation imposed or implied. So our topic for today is the winged dragon, the bird, and the butterfly. And it has to do with what? Human evolution, right? So what is going on here? If we take a moment and consider great nature, there's value in considering the creatures of the air, the water, the earth, that were held in past in veneration by races all over the earth. Something about how nature's forces, they might have been called the gods, operate through the forms that we see unimpeded, the natural flow of nature that can be seen in the animal kingdom. Well, we found a long time ago, we can correspond what's going on within the human being to what's going on around us, because all the forces and powers and faculties in great nature in a microcosm is in the microcosm of every human being, whether we realize it or not. You know, the idea, look within, thou art Buddha. Sometimes you look within And it's like, is that what Buddha looks like? I don't know. But when we look around in great nature, we can see the great forces that represent invisible processes in the visible forms. So we'll see things that are going on in ourselves in great nature. As we perceive universal forces, as creatures can symbolize to the concrete human mind some veiled principle, it's because the characteristics of the animal demonstrates an invisible principle, invisible action. So, one example of this, briefly, would be, as you know, we're talking about the winged serpent in this portion, then we'll be followed up by the bird and the butterfly. And then after that, there'll be opportunity for questions and discussion. If we just look at the serpent, when we use the word serpent, referring to ancient philosophy, the serpent is the same as the dragon. The serpent and the dragon are considered the same thing. So a serpent, if we look at a snake, just one example of the symbol of the snake is an example of a reincarnation. And this is simply because the snake annually sheds its skin, just as life after life, the ego, the inner being who we are, we shed our personality to take up another personality. And so too does is the analogy that the snake sheds its skin and reappears as a snake in a new outer skin. Now, serpent worship, however, in one form or another, has permeated the globe in all of the nations of antiquity. We're going to tick through a few of them just to give an impression to demonstrate how permeated the world is with these. First, we'll start with the giant serpent mound in Ohio, which some say was built by the American Indians, but others will say predates the American Indians by far. And it starts with a coiled tail and a snake scythering back and forth with an open mouth, and it looks like it's going to eat an egg. Now, this mound is about 800 feet long. If you stretch the snake out all the way, it's some 13 or 1400 feet long and 3 feet high. And it's been there for a long, long time. So the implication there is that serpents were something to some nation or some civilization right here in America that we otherwise have very little information about. Then also there's the carved stone snakes of Central and South America, the hooded cobras of India, the python, which is the great snake of Greek mythology. There's the sacred serpents of the Druids, that were driven out of Ireland by St. Patrick. And those serpents driven out by St. Patrick actually were the priest Druids themselves, because the word snake, or the word serpent, or dragon is synonymous with the initiate, with the wise one. This is one of the keys to understanding what ancient texts are talking about, including the Bible, when we see the word dragon or serpent, the wise one. There's the Midgard snake of Scandinavia, the Nagar of Burma, Siam, Cambodia, the serpents of Moses and the Pharaoh. You might remember that from the Old Testament, where the Moses's serpent swallowed whole the Pharaoh's serpent, which was symbolic for the wisdom of the Jews was superior to the wisdom of Egypt. That was the story in the Bible. There's the mystic serpent of Orpheus, the snakes at the Oracle of Delphi, sacred serpents in Egypt and in the Egyptian temples. And finally, of course, in the ancient mysteries, the serpent entwining a staff was the symbol for the physician. So it's all over the place. These serpents are all over the place. Among the ancients, the serpent was not, it was no devil. In certain times, among certain people, all symbols and all emblems can be interpreted in different ways. So perhaps in minor ways among some, it was recognized perhaps as a devil, but generally it was recognized as a wise being. It represented immortality, reincarnation, and it even represented psychic regeneration and eternity. How so? The symbol of the Ouroboros, which is the snake with the tail in its mouth, representing eternity. HBB has some things to say about that. Well, in the garden, as the serpent tempts man to a knowledge of himself, imagine how terrible that is. Well, in the Garden of Eden, this is the terrible snake tempting man towards self-knowledge. Is he not validating Christ's statement? Christ made a statement, "It's written in your law, I have said you are gods." This is the statement that's given to Jesus, who's said in the New Testament. And that law that he's talking about is Psalm 82, which says, maybe it's God saying to the Pharisees, "I said you are gods, you are all sons of the Most High." So then why the serpent in the Garden of Eden gets such a bad rap, we couldn't say. We couldn't say. But it's certainly inconsistent to see that the serpent in the Garden of Eden is Satan itself, to say that the certain it's inconsistent with the universal traditions of really what the serpent is. If that serpent is helping Adam and Eve gain the knowledge of themselves, is that really Satan working, or is it something else going on there? So, okay, well then, what is the source of this universal winged serpent or winged dragon tradition? It's hard to find that answer. It is in so many of the ancient texts, the symbol. But HPB tells us that it is so far prehistoric. She says, before our globe had become egg-shaped or round, it was a long trail of cosmic dust or fire mist, moving and writhing like a serpent. So before the earth was oval or round, it was a long writhing line like a serpent. Isn't that what's going on in the Serpent Mount in Ohio? See, most people will look at it. They see the coiled tail. They see seven back and forth like a, you know, the like a vibration, and then this, it's going for an egg. Well, no, the theosophist would say it's not going to eat the egg. That's the world egg being born from wisdom. It's not a snake eating an egg. It's wisdom giving birth to the world, this serpent mound. So she says this, say the explanations. She's talking about ancient explanations from the ancient teachings. Was the Spirit of God moving on the chaos until its breath had incubated cosmic matter and made it assume the annular shape of a serpent with its tail in its mouth, the emblem of eternity in its spiritual and of our world in its physical sense? Now, there's a legend in the beginning of the world, winged serpents rained from the sky. Who were these serpents? What were these serpents? Are they the sons of wisdom that the secret doctrine talked about? Were they what's known as the seraphim of Isaiah? What's interesting, the seraphim of Isaiah, if you look up the word seraphim, it's an angelic being of the highest order, of the highest celestial order of angels. And they're depicted in art as the seraphim. They're depicted as a physical angel, like the body of a man with wings behind the king, instructing the king. So it's interesting. They're teaching an appointed one, the king, on how to govern the people, the seraphim. Yet, if you look at the etymology of the word, of the Hebrew word seraphim, what do you think it means? It means dragon. HPB says that in all of the world's ancient religions, the word for dragon, which is kind of interesting because when she says in all of the world's ancient, the word for dragon meant these ancient teachings, the teachers, the wise ones. So that was Seraphim. So why the reptile? We were wondering, why is it a dragon? And what we found is that these wise ones, the original wise ones, if we're talking about the early earth and early man, there was a certain period, we talk about 18 million years ago, when man, as we know it, male and female, split of the sexes, when the forms first became what were usable forms by immortal souls, so we could incarnate into them. This was during the third race, during the middle of the third race, which is also known as the reptilian period. That's how far back it's going, interestingly. And it says, animals with bones, dragons of the deep, flying serpents were added to the creeping things. They that creep on the ground got wings. They of the long neck in the water became the progenitors of the fowls of the air. So it's basically saying the old dinosaurs became birds. Now, 100 years ago, any scientist would say that's ridiculous. But today, it's a given that dinosaurs are related to birds. Furthermore, during the third race, the boneless animals grew and changed. They became animals with bones. Their chayas, or their shadowy bodies, became solid. They were becoming more of the human that we understand. Animals separated first, male into female, and then the animals began to breed. The twofold man then separated. Back then he was twofold. Separated also. And man said, let us unite and make creatures. And they did. And so procreation began from the physical form. So she says, this was the first physical fall into matter of some of the existing and lower races. Bear in mind, the sons of wisdom had spurned the early third race, the non-developed, and are shown incarnating and thereby endowing with intellect the later third race. Well, this is all going on at the same time, it seems, that these creatures are evolving. So in the experience of the earliest evolution of the birth of mind or the incarnation of mind, there are winged serpents that are going on. And so this idea has come. How do we know? It's in every nation of antiquity. It's the mythology. And at the same time, who was there? The sons of wisdom, the great teachers who came on the scene early on, incarnated with early man, to teach the principles of life, of agriculture, et cetera, to start the human race off in certain principles. And then they arrived back during the fourth race, and then they arrived back during the fifth race. So we'll finish up here with, we already talked about the word seraphim in the Jewish language, the etymology of it is dragon, but it's referred to today as angels, wise angels instructing the king, but it also means dragon. Well, also in the ancient Greek, the word for dragon has an etymology which means one who sees clearly. And so now in Chinese, she says, in every ancient language, the word dragon signified what it now does in Chinese. In Chinese, it signifies the being who excels in intelligence. In Greek, he who sees and watches. Such qualifications were intended to apply to human originals, this is HPB, human originals who were symbolized by serpents and dragons. These originals, called in China today dragons of wisdom, were the first disciples of the Dianis, of the higher angels, who were their instructors. In short, they were the primitive adepts of the third race. And we also found it fascinating that if you just look up the word dragon and get what's called, have you ever seen in the dictionary, it says P-I-E, it means the Proto-Indo-European, the root of it, of the word dragon. and it means seer. How cool is that?
So, as was said, this month we've been looking at the natural symbols of human evolution. And there are just, as in the first talk was listing all the different ideas of the serpents and the dragon examples of symbols, so we can see in all of great nature the symbols of different, you know, like wolves and different kinds of cats and whatnot are symbols in so many of the different cultures. And we will be concentrating on the bird and the butterfly. And the bird is just, it was amazing how many different ideas of symbols we could find in different cultures. So we're going to focus, the only one we will focus on specifically, of course, will be the phoenix. But there are so many other types, and we'll go over initially what the bird in general means symbolically to man. And of course, we have to talk about the egg. There's no way we can talk about birds and not talk about the symbology of the egg. So to start off, we know that, of course, we know that birds fly. And if you've ever seen a slow motion close-up of how a bird takes off, it is absolutely fascinating, because how does he do that? He's just sitting on a branch and all of a sudden puts his wings out, pushes off, and he's gone. And they move so easily through the air from place to place. They can fly thousands of miles. There's a tern, with a T-E-R-N, that flies from the Arctic to the Antarctic and back every year, and hardly ever touches down on the ground. He spends most of his time in the air, or he's in the water. And we see this as the birds can accommodate through the earth, go into the sky. And it's almost like we're looking at physical manifestation into the spiritual, which is how we want to go. And then the student is kind of mundane, and then the student is looking for perfection. So there is a correlation here between the birds and symbolically the birds going from the earth into the atmosphere. And we want to read in the Voice of the Silence on page 5. HPB says, "Saith the great law, in order to become the knower of all self, thou hast first of self to be the knower. To reach the knowledge of that self, thou hast to give up self to non-self, being to non-being, and then thou canst repose between the wings of the great bird. Aye, sweet is rest between the wings of that which is not born nor dies, but is the Om throughout eternal ages." And the footnote on that page, when we're talking about that great bird, Kalahansa, the bird or swan, translated by the Theosophical Society, the syllable A is considered to be the bird Hans's right wing, U its left, M its tail, and it's also considered the swan. And when we're talking about the yogi who bestrides Hansa, it's not a, he's not affected by karmic influences, it says. So when we're looking at somebody who is not affected by karmic influences or sins, it says, we're looking at someone who's perfected. And Hansa also is meant to read, I am he, or reversed, he is I. And when we look at the two of these together, I am he is I, it identifies man's connection with his highest essence and divine wisdom. And when we're looking at both of these, we're looking at the idea of universality of all things. If he is I and I am he, we're looking, this is how the idea of universal brotherhood comes through, is that we are all each other. And Kala Hansa, or the swan, ancient thinkers also stated that the universe was produced by an egg dropped into chaos by the swan, who is also known as the swan of eternity, who lays at the beginning of time a golden egg, thought to be the vehicle of the divine ray. And by its beauty, the swan is also symbolizing the innocence of the initiate. So we'll look at the phoenix next. And the phoenix is also known as Bennu, B-E-N-U, or B-E-N-N-U, which is also a major symbol for the idea of rebirth, immortality, and cyclic rebirth. And he's also mentioned in the Egyptian Book of the Dead. And the phoenix is thought to be without a parent and has no offspring. And it takes its nourishment, we find it interesting, from sunlight. And it's this sunlight is even mentioned sometimes as fire and water. So these are the only things that this phoenix needs in order to survive. And it is said that the phoenix has a lifespan of 500 years. So we can see when we're looking at the cyclical rebirth idea of the phoenix, when we're looking at 500 years, and then when it's ready to die, it is said to build a funeral pyre, and he's said to clap his wings, and he catches on fire. But at that point, when it's just about all consumed, then a new phoenix reappears, takes on the essence of the fire and water, and then a new phoenix appears for another 500 years. So the mystery schools used this idea of the phoenix and the 500-year cycles as lifetime and to designate periods of existence. And also the initiates were referred to as phoenixes because of the initiations that they had gone through, giving up their mundane lives and being spiritually reborn. HPB says of the phoenix that it is the universal spirit that is looked at with the phoenix in these creation stories. It is the link with the spirit that hovers over the deep at the beginning. So we'll look at the egg now. And we want to start off by saying it was interesting in the first talk that the serpent mound in Ohio at the head of the serpent is the egg. Because we found doing our research, the idea of the mundane egg, actually, there were many pictures of the egg with a serpent wrapped around it. So this seems to be a very pertinent, important symbol when we're looking at these natural symbols, that of the egg and the serpent. So the secret doctrine puts forth the idea about how birds have aided in the creation of the cosmos. And HPB says, from a latent nothing was produced an active something needing only heat. Gradually evolving and breaking its own shell, the creature appeared to be a self-generated and a self-created being. The gradual development of the invisible germ within the closed shell, the inward working without any apparent outward interference of force, symbolized the origin and the secret of being. And again, a lot of cultures have these ideas of creation, and many of them have this idea of the egg, the mundane, the universal egg. They honor it. Its elliptical form describes the movement of heavenly bodies and of the earth itself. It describes the sphere of light that surrounds all living things. It is in the oviform that the potency of spirit in matter manifests. So when we actually look at this idea of the egg, and we will in a minute compare it to a cocoon of the butterfly, the egg starts out soft inside the mother bird, and we can't explain how it does wrap itself around the fetus. And then the bird is passed out. And we talked about heat last week's class. Again, as long as the mother bird keeps that egg warm, the bird will develop. And we know that if anything helps that bird come out of the shell, oftentimes the bird will die, because it develops its strength by pushing itself out of the egg itself. And that has to happen. Otherwise, the baby bird might die. And it is made specifically to do this, because when a baby bird is first born, people notice that on the tip of its beak, it has a little, almost like a little arrow tip kind of a thing that helps it break through. So the egg is definitely symbolic of so much of what we go through as humans and our spiritual progress to perfection, is that if we are helped too much, we may not be strong enough to pass on through the progress that we do need to make. And we have to do that. And we say self-induced and self-devised means in these classes all the time. And so we do need some help, but if we're helped too much, we won't develop that strength. So butterflies, beautiful little creatures. They are so fragile, yet so strong. When we think of the monarch and its migration that it does every year, and the thousands of them that are noted in certain areas in Mexico, we don't like to use the word awesome very much, but we understand it must be an awesome experience to view. So as we know, the butterfly starts out as a caterpillar or a chrysalis, but then again, it comes from an egg itself. And again, it's an extremely small egg that the caterpillar comes from. And we were reading what the caterpillar goes through with this metamorphosis that it performs before it becomes a butterfly. And just amazing because the insides of a caterpillar are different than the insides of a butterfly, and how the blood supply changes, and the organs actually change as well. And it was, you know, the essence that goes through the caterpillar, what these inner promptings that the caterpillar goes through to perform and make the cocoon, and then the inner promptings as it changes and metamorphosizes, we think we're probably pronouncing it wrong, into the butterfly, is just amazing. And again, it symbolizes us, how we have to have the inner promptings, the motivation, in order to learn and to progress and to learn the lessons that we need to learn in each lifetime to become perfected, to go through these initiations. And with the bird egg, as we said, it's an internal start for the egg, and then the mother puts forth the egg into the nest and then heats it. Whereas the cocoon, it's basically left on its own. And some of them even are able to manage throughout the winter. We forget which type of butterfly the cocoon actually lives through the winter. But we think how fragile looking the butterfly is, and yet it doesn't need the heat like the bird egg does. So we thought that was a really big difference between the two. So just to end, we wanted to just say that both examples of the struggle that the bird goes through to exit the egg, and the butterfly going from the egg to the cocoon to the full-grown butterfly, are symbols of the soul's struggle to grow, the initiation to perfection. Humanity being terrestrial, but perfection becoming aerial, such as the bird and the butterfly uniting with spirit. There is a divine plan guiding all of manifestation. So we'll take any questions. Okay.
Yes.
You alluded to at the very end that we can draw an analogy between birds and our mental processes and butterflies. You know, we can see characteristics of our mind that are that of a bird. But because we can imagine how a bird lives. A bird can't imagine how we live. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to find a correspondence between our own nature and the lower kingdoms of nature, like the birds and the bees and the so forth, and I'm not making sense.
Well, think of the changes that go on in every human being during puberty. And the adult that the child becomes, everything that was within the child is within the adult. And yet, in certain levels, the adult is so much more. So the child has become something different and more. Similarly, the caterpillar, when it forms that cocoon, there's not a cell in the butterfly that's the same as was in the caterpillar. And yet, you can train a caterpillar, to avoid toxins. Then it'll go into its cocoon, and when it emerges as a butterfly, every cell in the butterfly has changed, yet the butterfly knows to avoid the toxin. So it brings with it everything that it's learned and yet still becomes more.
But is there an analogy within us in our principles that correspond to these kingdoms of nature? You know, meaning like the birds, a bird's nature is hop from thing to thing and fly and so forth. We find our mind doing that. You know, hop from thing to thing and we get distracted.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's well, isn't that an expression that we use? You know, someone who's bird-brained. Just a thought. I don't know.
Well, we are made up of the lower kingdoms. And we have the animal in our cells, we have the mineral in our cells. So we are made up of them. We do have an animal nature in our, you know, in our karmic nature is considered the animal nature. So in that respect, we do have the, when we talk about the mind, the lower mind being connected with the karmic nature, we are in many respects, that's looked at as the animal soul. So we do have that part of the animal within us. And we shouldn't say we've all, but many of us have experienced that idea of rage. And people say, look, he's acting like an animal. And there is, it's almost like you just kind of lose everything. And that's almost like the rage, say, from like a lion or a tiger when it's attacking. So we can look at it that way.
Yes.
Yeah. In the first part of the lecture, you were talking about the serpentine nature and the races and bringing the upper and the lower and the manifestation in that in this plane with the different reptilian races. What is the definition of a race from the theosophical your point? What is that when we're talking about race?
Yeah, so when we talk about races of mankind in theosophy, what does that mean? All it simply means is humanity is one and humanity collectively evolves. A snapshot of humanity, of the spiritual evolution at the time, is a race. There are seven great races that are broken down into seven sub-races, which are broken down into family races. So there's a process of evolution. So when we talk about race in theosophy, it all has to do with collective humanity at a given point in time. It's materialized in different ways, degraded and crystallized, and that is not what we're talking about in theosophy.
Okay. And could you just maybe touch on the serpentine and how you were connecting that there was a certain third race with
right.
that, with the serpentine nature and how we evolved from
that's what was interesting. To pretend to Ashley to give any kind of details, we can't give a lot of details about that because it's simply not given out. But there's reference to the process of evolution prior to the form being ready for human incarnation. It went through all the different kingdoms. That doesn't mean that human beings used to be amoebas. Human beings are solar beings. We are beings of light. The intelligence which evolves through the kingdoms to eventually form a human shape is what evolves through the kingdoms. That's not the same as saying, you know, we used to be reptiles. Are you with us? Okay. Okay. In that.
Well, the words that come to our mind are two words, analogy and correspondence. And we all in grammar school studied and read about Hiawatha, the Red Riding Hood, and so many different fairy tales. None of us could imagine that when we reached adulthood, referring back to those tales and stories, by analogy and correspondence, it opens up something in us, the realization of our nature. How we are made up, and the place in evolution of the self-conscious human being. And by a comparison, etc., we arrive at an ethical
nature
of these terms we use, teaching us about our nature and our place in the whole scheme of evolution.
Thank you. There was a hand here in the green shirt.
We're wondering with the chrysalis, it must be in the sun. It must get its heat from the sun. And also, as far as the rage in the animals go, that we said we're acting like animals if we go into a rage, that the rage in the animals is actually the rage from our kingdom that we've put in there. That when the lion will lay down with the lamb is an allegory of when we're finally, after seven rounds and seven races, that it's all balanced out and it's all... We're a race of the depths, and everything is very peaceful. And we're supposed to be raising up the animals so that they can, and eventually, in the next round, or the next great period of evolution, that they will be coming up into the human kingdom.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes?
How does the symbol of the sperm fit into everything we've been talking about?
Could
you repeat the question?
How does the symbol of the sperm correspond in here?
Well, we wonder. This is total intuitive on our part. We don't remember reading anything about that. But once the sperm enters into the egg, that's when the whole, the metamorphosis of the egg occurs, and genetic splicing and the whole formation of the fetus and everything. And it's almost like the lighting up of mind. We don't know, but we wonder if there's some kind of a correlation on that part, because when the lighting up of mind occurred, that's when man became enlightened, so to speak, and then with the entrance of the sperm into the ovum, that's when the whole process of fetal development occurs.
Yes.
Well, if we look at that physiological process and see it as a mirror of what's going on in great nature on higher planes, the egg represents the female aspect of nature, the male, the spiritual, one material, one spiritual. And all of these ancient allegories and stories from around the world, you have the idea of creation beginning as a ray of spirit falling into the mundane egg and stirring it, and from there you have the birth of the universe. There's so much correspondence and analogy between the birth of a universe as described there and the birth of a human being. It's almost as above, so below.
Thank you.
Yes.
So what is meant by the expression that be wise as serpents? Does that go along with the talk?
Well, this idea that, as we understand it, it was Jesus talking to his disciples, telling them to go out and to instruct people in the principles of Jesus's teachings. Well, isn't that what the original sons of wisdom did when they incarnated among incipient man to instruct him in right ethical teaching? And considering that it is so permeated all of the ancient traditions, it's pretty easy to see that that's exactly what he was talking about, especially if he had in mind the Old Testament teachings of the seraphim, who were serpents. Yes?
What is meant by the term language?
I think that has to do with butterflies.
Can you expound on that a little bit?
Well, we're speaking, we're in conversation, and we assume that everyone understands every other person. We speak the same language, in this case, English. So the terms we use are known, and we learn that from the cradle. So language is what we're talking about today. And spiritual language, one of the most difficult forms of expression, because we've lost the means of interpretation of what it means, a certain meaning.
So it's the idea of language then, both of our talks included how the different cultures have included all of the, a lot of these symbols, a lot of them the same, and it's a language that goes across time and goes across cultures, because we can see, even if in regards to the serpents and the birds, there are different types of serpents, there are different types of birds, but when we look at the language really that's being used, there's a commonality between them all. So we can, there has to, with the, when we're looking at these ancient cultures and we're still looking at the same stories that are being told throughout time, throughout different peoples, that it's almost a confirmation that yes, indeed, there has to be a reason why there's so much, like the creation stories. And next week, we're doing another symbolic one, that there has to be a common source for these ideas.
So an example of a common language, or rather common ideas that can be, you know, grasped, that have nothing to do with the same spoken word, is again that Ohio mound. Because what we've been talking about, the snake, its tail is wound three times, and then it goes out into the cyclic form. Well, does that stand for the three races? Not until the third race does it break out, and the cycle of, you know, the cycle that the serpent is going through, it's seven cycles. Now, its mouth is open, and a lot of people who look at something like that and say, well, it's an egg, it's just a big thing that a snake's eating an egg. Okay, well, think about language. In the Gospel of John, in the beginning was the Word was God, and the Word was with God. Well, so God spoke manifestation into existence, the Word, and isn't it actually HPB saying that snake was the cosmic dust that eventually formed the world? So in Ohio, what we're really looking at is wisdom spewing, forming, creating, speaking the word, and the word is that world egg. It's not an egg that the snake is going to eat. So right interpretation of symbols is very helpful, but it's the same thing that was being put forth in the first Gospel of John. Yes?
In a wider application, implication of the understanding of the animal kingdom as symbolic of human evolution, it may be interesting to just mention that how in all the different countries and civilizations, the symbols for the zodiac and for the astrological symbols for the seven signs of the zodiac are all using pretty much the same kinds of animals, but and similar kinds of meanings attached with those animals. Is there anything that can be said on that?
Yes, isn't that fascinating? The idea that all these different nations seemingly unable to communicate with each other because of distance and water, etc., have common symbols for the zodiac. Well, wouldn't that speak to a common teaching to all of mankind? And if there's a common teaching, then it has to be a common doctrine. How is that common doctrine taught? Through this brotherhood, which arrived at the time that mind was lit up, so to impress certain principles, ideas, and instruction upon the human race to get it started in the right foot. And again, specific humans, early humans, were picked and taught and instructed in the mysteries. Those who were lit up more so than you know, there were others who were only lit as a spark. So it was a matter of, once these elder brothers moved on, it was a matter of mankind working and teaching together in brotherhood to continue the education and the evolution of the race.
And many of the pictographs and wall paintings that have been found, a lot of them, well, we should say probably most of them, probably will be found to have common common ideas that have used animals as well. I mean, and humans in different ways of like maybe farming or home or whatever. A lot of things will be in common. So when we're looking at symbolic representations, we can see throughout the world, going back into early times, that there is a common denominator to all of this. Because how can it be that we find things here in the United States that are similar in some respects to caves that are found in the Middle East? There has to be that commonality, as was just talked about.
Yes.
You talked about the serpent as a symbol, and you didn't mention the theosophical symbol. I think that would be a nice thing to touch on, because that's such a powerful symbol, and there's so much in that.
Sure. Well, there's in one of the symbols, actually, is the Ouroboros, which is the snake people say the snake swallowing its tail. More specifically, it's the snake with its tail in its mouth, which actually represents human regeneration. Well, what is that? The process of, let's just say, the process of maybe transmutation of ideas, or the transmutation of oneself, isn't the building of oneself by getting stuff and building it. It's taking what you have and transmuting it. We're told that we are dynamos, generators of force, to transmute lower forces into higher. And the idea is, by consuming ourselves, consuming our lower forces, to transmute them into greater, higher expressions of spirit. So that's the Ouroboros, the snake with the tail in its mouth. Then there's also the symbol of the Theosophical Society that HPB formed, which is the T with the snake, very similar to that of the physician. But also, if you consider it, that T can be considered a cross. And the snake wrapping itself around, we're going to have to leave that to the intuition, because it's the end. Please.
Yeah. So our meeting is over. And thank you, everyone, for coming. Thank you.